This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown died Friday at the age of 78 after suffering a heart attack and stroke following surgery. We're going to remember her today by listening back to a 1997 interview. Ruth Brown was nicknamed Miss Rhythm by the singer Frankie Lyman. She was one of Atlantic Records' first hit makers, and in the 1950s she was their most prolific and best-selling performer. She recorded over 80 songs for Atlantic between 1949 and 1962. Her best-known records include Teardrops from My Eyes, 5-10-15 Hours, Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean, and Lucky Lips. Her 1958 recording, This Little Girl's Gone Rockin', has recently been used in a TV commercial for Hummer. Ruth Brown started her comeback in the 80s when she starred in the Broadway revue Black and Blue, for which she won a Tony Award. She also co-starred in John Waters' film Hairspray as Motormouth Mabel. In 1993, the year she turned 65, she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. In addition to her hits, she's remembered in the music world for her successful efforts to recoup her royalties from Atlantic and to fight for royalty reform for artists of her generation whose contracts came to be seen as exploitive. Let's start with her 1953 recording, Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean. Started singing in church.
Mm-hmm.
What was the church and what was the music?
Well, I started singing in church not necessarily because that was of my choosing, but that was the rule. You know, my dad, and coming from a Southern family, I don't know. I wouldn't say that because it was a Southern family that was the norm, but I think that practically any R&B artist, the most of us of my ethnic persuasion, started singing in the church. If indeed at all you did have any kind of a talent, the understanding was it was something that was God-given and you had to give that back. And so my father insisted that if I didn't sing in the church, I was not going to sing at all, you know.
So what kind of singing did you do in church?
Well, I was sort of twisted between my father's church was Methodist, and they have sort of just flat-footed inspirational spirituals, I call it. You know, His Eyes on the Sparrow and Precious Lord and those things. That was in my father's church. But now, on the other hand, in the summer when I went to North Carolina, which where my mother's people were, to work and sharecrop in the fields in the summer, we went to a Baptist church, and it was totally different. You know, in the Baptist church, we didn't have the big organ and all of that like we had in the Methodist church. The music was made by patting of the foot, clapping of the hands, and everything was just done with the human voice. And, of course, it was so joyous. And on the other side, if it wasn't joyous, it was so depressing. You know, there were songs like, Sit Down, Sinner, You Better Sit Down. Sit Down, Sinner, You Better Sit Down. You ain't going to heaven, so you better sit down. If that didn't take your spirit away, nothing did, you know. And then on the other hand, you had I Got Shoes and You Got Shoes. All God's children got shoes. When I get to heaven, I'm going to put on my shoes. Dance all over God's heaven. So in my father's church, I was christened. because that was the way of the Methodists. But, and my mother's and my grandmother in North Carolina, she insisted that unless you were submerged in the deep water, you hadn't done a thing. And so I stood on line at the creek and was submerged in water. So I was baptized, you know, so the Spirit had me on either side. So, you know.
Another exposure to music you had was when you were in North Carolina for the summers working in the cotton fields. A lot of people sang and shouted there. Sing me some of the things you heard in the cotton fields.
Oh, my goodness. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, and oh, Lord, have mercy on me. Oh, Lord, have mercy on me. Oh, Lord, have mercy. Have mercy on me. When the world's on fire, when the world's on fire, when the world's on fire, Lord, have mercy. Mercy on me. And then there was like, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
Did you sing yourself when you were working in the fields?
Oh, occasionally. But I think that by that time I had started to listen on the radios back in Virginia and hear some things that I wanted to really get into musically. Of course, I was exposed, first of all, to country and western before anything else, you know. And then after country and western, the war years, I listened to like the Andrews Sisters and Bing Crosby and Vaughn Monroe.
This is on the radio.
Oh, this is radio. Oh, yeah. Well, radio's always been the intermediary, you know. And one thing about radio was that it very possibly was one of the reasons that rhythm and blues, as I knew it, eventually turned into rock and roll. There had to be a change because what the kids were hearing, they had the privilege of turning that dial, listening to whatever they wanted to listen to without seeing the color of your skin or who you were or what you looked like. And they were dancing to the music. And so, just like in a lot of other things, this had to make some changes because now was going to be something that was exposed. People were dancing, even though they had ropes down the center of the barnyards and all. When I played the dances, the ropes fell down lots of times, and the white kids and the black kids danced together. Nobody said a thing about it until some big official, a sheriff or something, would come up and say, stop the music and put the ropes back in place. So the music itself had already started to become the common denominator, you know?
Ruth Brown, you started your singing career singing mm-hmm. at USO clubs.
Yes.
Was this during World War II or after?
Yes, this was, well, it was between 1941 and 1945, you know, which was Pearl Harbor, was December 7, 1941. And these were the war years.
Well, you were a teenager. You were.
I was.
You were
indeed.
In your early teens during part
indeed
of this.
Indeed, I was.
So, what was it like for you as a young teenager to be singing for soldiers?
Well, to tell you the truth, I sort of snuck in to sing with the soldiers. My dad didn't know it in the beginning, because I had gotten a job working at the USO, working behind the soda fountain. And so I was allowed to go into the USO because I had a part-time job in there, so everybody thought. But my basic reasons was to get in and work and sing with that little USO show that was rehearsing there quite often. And a number of times, and I was supposed to be in choir practice on Thursdays, I was up with the USO show. You know.
So what'd your father do when he found out?
Singing. And my dad walked in one night. Oh, sure. Somebody told him. And he walked in one night unannounced. And I was up on stage. I'll never forget. I was singing Chattanooga Choo Choo. And I tell you, my dad was that person, you know. He just didn't have to say a word. He had a look about him, you know. And there was something in his stride, you know, when he walked. There was like you talk about body language, it was body language. And all he did was walk to the edge of the stage and look straight up at me and beckon. You know, he didn't open his mouth. All he did was come to the edge of the stage, beckon, and point, like with his finger, and say, come on down, you know. And you knew what he meant, and you knew what to expect when you got down off of that stage. But I met the force. May the force be with you. The force was with me even then when I came down, because my dad didn't even wait for me to get outside the building. He decided that if I had ignored him, then he was going to make what I had done public. And he gave me my whipping right there in public, you know. Of course, that didn't stop me. I kept sneaking around trying to sing with these shows, and did quite a few of them, you know, until I was just struggling to get to be of an eligible age, you know, when you get to be that 17 or 18, which I wasn't going to wait on anyway.
You say at some point that you realized that you could make more money singing two nights a week than your father could make working a full week.
That's right.
And I'm wondering, as a girl, what impact that realization had on you?
Well, it was really important because I was the oldest of eight children. And being a girl had nothing to do with the fact that what your position in life was as the oldest. I was the first one that had to go to work. My dad was a dockhand and a laborer. And I remember going many times to pick up his paycheck or his little brown envelope with the monies in it. At that time, they didn't have checks. They just rolled up what little money they would do and put them in a little brown envelope, and that was it. And I know that he made up to $35 a week, which was big money for him. But when I went out and sang and earned $35 in one night, I knew that something here was wrong. You know, something was definitely wrong. And I'm sure that had it not been for the fact that he was a young father with all these children, if the opportunity had presented itself, he very possibly could have been a great singer, because he had a wonderful baritone voice. And I'm almost sure that sometimes now, since I've become a woman, an elderly woman now, and I look back on all of that, I realize he was probably very frustrated sometimes, because he saw in me a lot of what could have very possibly mm-hmm. happened for him, you see?
You won one of the amateur nights at the Apollo yes. sessions in, I guess it was the late 1940s.
Yes.
And then must have been 1948 or 49, Atlantic Records wanted to sign you. And yes. they were going to bring you up north again, this time for a paid date at the Apollo.
Yes.
What happened to you when you were driving up north to play the Apollo?
Well, we were due to be at the Apollo that Thursday for a 3 o'clock in the afternoon rehearsal, which was what they did. And you rehearsed downstairs in a little place under the main theater. And we left Washington, D.C. En route to New York to be there in time for that rehearsal. And I would assume it was about, I guess, 8:45 in the morning of October 29th. I remember it well, outside of Chester, Pennsylvania. I'm still not sure what happened. Maybe the gentleman driving might have gone to sleep at the wheel. I don't know. All I know is that I remember a screeching of tires, and I remember a crash, you know, and I remember then finally hearing somebody say, the girl in the back is dead, and that they were talking about me. And they took everybody else out before they did me. And finally, when they came to move me, when they went to straighten my leg, my left leg had been broken 3 or 4 places and was back up under my body. They tried to straighten me out to pick me up, and that's when I screamed. And they realized that I was indeed not dead, just in a state of shock.
You were unable to talk until then?
Yes, I couldn't speak. I couldn't speak, whatever the reasons, and my vision, because the suitcase had fallen and hit me in the face and in the head. But I did end up in Chester Hospital and was there for 11 months and something. And once I was released after that period, in fact, my contract with Atlantic was signed while I was a patient in the hospital. they came over for my 20th birthday and brought the contracts, and I signed them on my bed in the hospital there at Chester. And when I finally did get out of the hospital, they brought me to Philadelphia, and I stayed up in North Philadelphia on Butler Street with Cab Calloway's sister, Blanche Calloway, for many, many months until I was able to manipulate around on some crutches, and then I started singing around Philadelphia and all the little clubs, you know.
Well, I guess this brings us to your first record, made in 1949.
Yes.
For Atlantic Records. It
yes.
was called So Long.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell us about your memories of this first recording.
I remember
session.
Going in the studio on crutches to do this tune.
So long. Hope we'll meet again someday. Oh, that maybe then you'll say, darling, I was wrong. So long.
When you became a rhythm and blues star, you toured with some of the rhythm and blues and rock and roll shows. And I'm wondering if you could give us a taste of what it was like for you as a performer to be in those rock and roll shows.
Oh, it was wonderful, but of course, they came along a little later. I think they started, there was a father and son team out of West Virginia who booked all those shows called the Super Shows. The Weinbergs were the promoters, and they put these shows together. They had this brilliant idea. And at one time, there were people on the bus like the Clovers, the Drifters, the Five Keys, Lester Young, Buddy Johnson's orchestra, Ella Johnson, and then you would have like a Sam Cooke, you know, and you would have a John Coltrane, and you would have Paul Huckabuck Williams and Charles Brown and Roy Brown. And sometimes there were about 10 acts on one bill, and the ticket only cost about $7.50, you know.
So you're saying,
but it was wonderful.
Did Lester Young share the bill with the Drifters and the Clovers?
Oh, of course, with me.
Uh-huh.
Well, of course.
Must have been an awfully interesting bus ride.
It was interesting, but we were so young and naive, I didn't realize the greatness of a lot of these people I was working with. So,
was there ever a point during your adult life when you couldn't earn a living singing and you had to do other jobs?
Oh, yes, of course.
What did you
do?
Of
course. I did domestic work. I drove a school bus.
You did domestic work after you had rhythm and blues hits?
Oh, sure. This was during the 60s. That wasn't too long ago. This was during the 60s, the advent of the Beatles and the British invasion. And the business became a little more complicated. But that wasn't really the reason I left, because I really chose... somewhere down the line, it started to sort of ease back because I had two wonderful children and I wanted to spend more time where they were. And it went back a few years before that I had thoughts of it, because my mother used to take care of my sons. And I remember coming home one time to visit. My only tie to my children had been material things, you know, things that you could send money home for and purchase gifts. And I came home, and my oldest, of course, was jovial and jumping up. But my baby, when I went to reach for my baby, he didn't want me to touch him, and he screamed and yelled, you know. And I think that was probably the first day that I said to myself, well, I got to do something about this. And that was one of the reasons that I finally decided to come in, so to speak. But in those times, I did many things. I did domestic work. I cooked. I worked in daycare. I worked in the home for retarded children. I worked in drug abuse as a counselor. I drove a school bus. I worked in Head Start. I worked wherever I could bring a paycheck home, you know.
Well, how did you feel after the adulation that you'd get on stage cleaning other people's houses?
Well, I didn't feel anything about it because what I was doing was earn a living, a clean, decent living. And it was what my mother had done all of her life, so I felt no shame about it because I did that with as much dignity as I do anything else. I did a good job. I was a good housekeeper, you know. And it wasn't until my needs were of such that I was cleaning house one day and I heard my music. I heard a disc jockey talking about my greatness and how great Ruth Brown was. And at that time, I think I was scrubbing a floor. And that is when I sort of made up my mind that there was some money that belonged to me that I had not been receiving. You know, I had not gotten a royalty statement in almost 30 years. I hadn't seen one, you know. And my records were being sold all over the country, and he was talking about how big this was in Japan and in Germany, and I had no idea about this. So I began this battle, this uphill battle it was, to maintain and reclaim something that was really mine. I refused to beg because I was going to fight for I knew what was mine. You know, if these records are being sold, then I'm entitled to my part of whatever they're being sold for. Now, after all these years, I'm getting record royalties back again for the first time in many, many years, you know.
You made a comeback in the 80s with a series of music theater reviews, including Black and Blue. And I'm wondering now how, when you're performing on stage, the feeling and the audience compare with the earlier part of your career in the 50s.
It's kind of awesome. But the beautiful thing is that there are a lot of young faces out there that are now becoming aware of this music that I was a part of. And a lot of them, not because they knew my music, but I did another crazy thing one day. I did a film called Hairspray. And I gained a whole following of new young people with that crazy movie.
It's a great movie. It's a John Waters movie.
Yes, ma'am. With Ricky Lake.
Yeah, with Ricky Lake. It was her first big role.
Yes.
And it's about one of those dance shows in Baltimore.
It was
kind of like
an
American Bandstand, but one set in Baltimore.
It was a real show. Yeah. I remember the reality of it. And it was in a time when John Waters was a young man. He grew up hearing that. And I remember those situations very, very well.
Uh-huh.
And I had said, well, I'm not going to do this film, especially when they took me to wardrobe and brought that white wig out. I said, not on your life, you know. But, of course, it was I can't call his name. He died.
Divine.
I call him the Divine. He came to me and said, girl, put that wig on your head and make some money. And I said to him, no, I'm going to lose every fan I've got in the world if I come out with this white wig. And Divine said, well, I tell you what, for everyone you lose, I'm going to bring you two. And every time I see that film, and it runs continuously, and I've gone into grocery stores and see young people following me around, my ego says, oh, they know who I am, Ruth Brown, that kind of thing. And then they will eventually say, aren't you Motormouth Maybelle?
That was your role in the movie.
That was my role and continues to be my claim to fame. You know, that cult film has really been wonderful. I go to the mailbox quite often now and find a little check with John Waters, God bless him, on it. He writes to me and sends me crazy Christmas cards and things until this day.
Well, Ruth Brown, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. I've done all the talking, you see.
Ruth Brown, recorded in 1997. She died last week at the age of 78.
Along about the evening, I feel so blue. And though my heart is grieving, I'll wait for you. I'm writing you a letter.